History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and invest a little bit of time. Maybe you'll be motivated to do that with someone in your life. But our aim here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Robbie Robinson spent most of his life in California, but he lives now in Henderson, Nevada. We're going to hear some of his experiences with the 11th Armored Division in the Battle of the Bulge and beyond. But let's start out with his early years in Compton, California.
Compton, California in 1925, when I was born, was a very, very quiet, middle-class little town. My dad was working for Firestone Tire and Rubber as an electrician, learning the trade, really. He wasn't an electrician yet. You could walk all over town. Nobody would bother you. I lived there until I was 12. And one of the things we used to do is get on the Pacific Electric car for a nickel and go into downtown Los Angeles to the little street there, what the heck's the name of it, at any rate, and get taquitos with green sauce, and that was a dime. And then one of the other things that we did from Compton was get on the Pacific Electric and go to the beach and take what we called a skimmer board. And these were, I find out, I was one of the original kids that did skimming on the thing. And we'd make our own plywood board and then throw it down on about 2 inches of water and jump on it and scale into the waves. And that was way before even surfing was a big deal as far as Hawaii went, but it wasn't in the United States yet. But we were skimming clear back then. Then when I lived in San Diego, well, then that whole area down there, Ocean Beach clear down to the Navy base, was an excellent place to do that. And I had a house on the beach there that was $90 a month, and you're 50 feet from the sand. You could hear the ocean every night, you know, crashing. Beautiful situation.
As you're that kid, you know, and taking the Pacific Electric here and there, were there some ideas you had at a young age, some thoughts of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do?
No, actually, my dad was, it wasn't until I got back out of the military that I realized that he was electrical contracting, and he needed, desperate to need help, working out of the back of his car. I went down and bought a brand new pickup, paid cash for it. When I came home, I had $12,000 in the bank. And I got that by trading with the Russians on the border of Czechoslovakia when we ended up at Linz in Austria, in that area. And we were there long enough to trade with the Russians. They had been paid in 5 years. And their theory was that you had your room and board and food and whatever, so you didn't need any cash. So then they paid them, and they had pockets full of cash, and they didn't know what to do with it. Most of them were uneducated. In fact, as I remember, one place in Linz, Austria, a Russian was going down the street carrying a toilet, had no idea that it needed plumbing, and none of them knew how to drive, but they were fascinated with the cars, and they would try to get somebody to get out of the car and commandeer the car, but they didn't know how to operate it. So it was pretty sad. But one of the things that they did have, because they had so much money, that they would buy a pair of GI shoes that we were trying to get rid of for free. They were brand new, $50 American. And then a watch like I had, you could buy at the PX for $7, were $300 American. So it was very easy to make a whole bunch of money real fast. And then the first thing you did is wire it home. And my dad would put it in the bank for me. So when I came home, why, he thought I was absolutely wealthy. And I had about $12,000 bucks in the bank.
Back then, that's quite wealthy. And I know you told me that when you were 12, your family moved up to Kern County to Taft, and you started high school there and then continued high school back on the other side of the grapevine. I'm curious, though, what you remember about December 7th, 1941, because it seems like everybody remembers something. Do you remember where you were and how you found out?
Yeah, I remember listening to Roosevelt on the radio when they attacked Pearl Harbor, and I was 16, and I realized then, guess what? I don't know where you're going to be, but you're going to be in the military. One way or another, that's a given thing. We were in actually Taft, California. The interesting thing about that was that when I was 12 up there, my dad said, well, you're a big boy now. We'll give you a rifle. So he gave me a .22, 500 rounds of ammunition. I'd learn to take the gun apart, put it back together, know all about it. Then he would say, okay, now you take 5 shells and go out and come back. We would go out hunting almost every day. I had a little buddy that also went with me. He had a gun. And so I actually grew up from that time when I was young, probably 12, 13, 14, hunting and hiking. We lived 12 miles from Buena Vista Lake. And we would hike and not even think about it, hunting, plinking away at stuff. I didn't like to kill game, but I liked to shoot at it. So you got pretty good at missing them real close. And we'd hike to the lake, wade around in the lake a little bit, then hike over to the main highway from Bakersfield to Taft, stand there with your gun in your hand, and they'd pick you up and take you back into town. So this was, you know, a standard thing that the kids all had. But it paid off very well because when I got in the service, I not only was aware of the gun, but I could shoot. And an awful lot of guys from other areas had never handled a rifle. So this put me about 2 steps above everybody else. I could hit the target. Then I did that also with a tank gun. They would strap a .45 to the barrel of the tank gun, align it so that you could use the firing mechanism in the tank to aim at little matchbooks and things like this in the ground, like 50 feet out in front of the tank. And you learn how to manipulate the gun, and then you'd fire that .45. And that was a fun thing to do for me. Most guys wanted to go in town and get drunk. I didn't drink, and alcohol didn't agree with me, so I didn't drink. So I'd go out and do this tank thing. And as a result, I became an expert at tank gunnery. And as a result, I got into serious trouble.
Well, and we're going to hear about that, and you'd end up in the 11th Armored Division, but that's not what you were initially thinking when you were going into the service. Tell me the story of how you ended up in the military, what you thought was going to happen versus what actually unfolded.
We had an opportunity to go to any service you wanted. The Marine guy had a leg missing. I didn't really appreciate that. The Navy, I said, no, I want any part of the water. If your ship sinks, you're in the water. So I think the best thing to do is stay on dry land. So I went over to the Army, and the old sergeant there said, well, what you do is you go to Fort Knox, Kentucky, and you go to Officer's Candidate School. When you graduate, then you can transfer into the Air Corps. Well, I didn't know it at the time that was practically a lie. So I went into Fort Knox, Kentucky to go into training for that type of thing. And I find out that the attrition for second lieutenants in tanks was about 80% North Africa. So I decided that's not a good idea. So then they said, well, you have a pretty good memory. Maybe you ought to go into reconnaissance. At that time, they didn't have any way to fly over and observe. You had to go out and memorize the terrain and then come back and tell them what's what. And essentially, that's what we ended up doing.
Which is a really dangerous job, isn't it?
Well, unfortunately, the guys, I had 22 guys in our platoon, and 18 of them got killed or wounded. So, you know, I got out with hardly any problems at all. I was afraid to re-enlist, though, because he tried to kill me.
Was it the intelligence and reconnaissance platoon?
Well, G2 is sort of like intelligence. They had us go out and pick up information. They would leave information, you know, they couldn't broadcast it. you can't mail it. So they would, the Office of Strategic Services, OSS people, would leave information at a particular point, and they'd have us go out and sometimes pick that up. Sometimes you'd go out early in the morning, sometimes at night. The object was to get out there and retain that and get back without being seen or caught or shot at. You had to be pretty elusive to do that.
Well, and I want to hear some of those stories, examples that check some of those boxes. But first of all, tell me what it was like when you were heading overseas, because you're still a pretty young man, and I'm guessing you've never done anything like this before. Did you think that you would make it back, that you'd come back and see your family again?
We went on the HMS Cimmeria, which was a British ship. They sailed around the North Atlantic, putting a convoy together for almost a month before we started for Europe. They were feeding us kind of a watery oatmeal and stewed apricots, three meals a day. And we find out later that they had all kinds of American food stored in the lockers there, but they were taking it home to the folks in England. And we didn't get any of that food. So that kind of turned me against the English, and I happened to be one of them.
Did it turn you against apricots, too?
No, actually not really. They were greedy, like everybody else, and taking advantage of anything they possibly could. You learn by experience. One of the things, I had a Mohawk haircut and a good suntan, and I had a pretty good sized knife that I carried with me. They thought I was a Native American. You know, had no idea that I was an Englishman like they were.
Yeah, you were telling me earlier, your father was from England?
Yeah, my dad immigrated from England in 1906, or I don't remember. Anyway, he came over with a bunch of other Robinsons. They're all related. They all came as a group, scattered out. And I have relatives that I've never seen, but I don't even know where they are.
Well, I know it's a long time ago, 1944, when you're heading across the Atlantic. But do you remember what you expected, what you thought was going to happen, or what it felt like to be doing that?
Well, the thing is that I enjoyed sailing. In fact, there's a lot of times I'd go up near the bow of the ship and just watch the thing crash into the waves and then come back up. It was an enjoyable crossing, although it was somewhat stormy, but I enjoyed it like, you know, I guess I would have made a pretty good sailor. But coming home, I was on the USS George Washington, which was the largest ship that the Americans had at the time. And we had 4,500 WACs and nurses all on board, plus the GIs coming back from there. And I got seasick for 2 days. And then they organized a theater group or a show. So I emceed that and did some voices and told some jokes and stuff like that. But I'd been doing that. In fact, after the war was over, I helped organize a band. I don't play a musical instrument, but I could seem to put guys together, and we organized a band, and I went along as the MC and stuff like that. It was fun.
And you mentioned voices. We haven't talked about this yet, but even after the war, you did radio drama where you would do voiceover voices and impressions and stuff. Where did that come from? Is that something you did as a kid?
Yeah, in fact, when I was in about the third or fourth grade, something like that, I found out I could do Donald Duck. The kids would ask me to do that. Then I realized that I could mimic some of the other radio voices. So we put together a little script, a little program, and entertain people at various activities, and were invited to do that. And that was kind of the forerunner to getting involved in some of the theater that I did later.
And I know you're 97 now, but can you still do any of those voices?
I can. There was a program called The Life of Riley. One of the characters on there was Digby Odell. Digby Odell was the friendly undertaker. And usually when he was coming on the program, of course you have to imagine this because it's not like television, why he would be maybe walking down the street or something, he'd come across to Riley and he'd say, "Good evening, Riley. 'Tis me, Digby Odell. You're looking fine today. Very natural. You know, I was in the golf course and they wouldn't let me play. I kept digging up the green."
That's pretty good. I used to listen to that program on the Golden Age of Radio Theater, Digby Odell, the Friendly Undertaker. I'm glad you still got it. And if any other voices come to mind later, feel free to share that inspiration. And that was some gallows humor with Digby Odell, but you were going into a situation where it was life and death. When did you realize that? Was there a moment where it hit you that this is really extreme and this could cost you your life?
Well, you know, the first thing off the bat, we were in the Battle of the Bulge. There was no room. You didn't get room service. I just don't understand it. And there wasn't any place to sleep except in the snow. So you had to learn how to curl up and stay warm, try to dig through the snow to the ground and maybe dig a foxhole or something like this. And that was for several days, you know, before we did that kind of thing. Unfortunately, we were not clothed or shoed for that time of weather.
And we can all imagine what that means, but we want Robbie Robinson to spell it out for us. So we'll do that when we come back. Close calls, concentration camps, and more recently, an honor flight to our nation's capital. We'll try to cover it all when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.